The 4 million, by O. Henry. Tilda, not very long ago someone invented the assertion that there were only 100 people in New York City who were really worth noticing. But a wiser man has arisen, the census taker, and his larger estimate of human interest has been preferred in marking out the field of these little stories of the R million. Tilda. Contents. Tobin's palm, the gift of the Magia Cosmopolite in a cafe between rounds, the skylight room, a service of love, the coming out of Maggie Mann about town, the cop, and the anthem, an adjustment of nature, memoirs of a yellow dog, the love filter of Ike Sheenstein, Mammon, and the archer, springtime, a la carte, the green door from the cabbie seat, an unfinished story, the caliph, Cupid and the clock, sisters of the golden circle, the romance of a busy broker after 20 years, lost on dress parade by courier, the furnished room, the brief debut of Tildy, $$$ and Tobin's palm, Tobin and me, the two of us, went down to Coney one day, for there was $4 between us, and Tobin had need of distractions. For there was Katie Maherner, his sweetheart, of County Sligo, lost since she started for America 3 months before with $200, her own savings, and $100 from the sale of Tobin's inherited estate, a fine cottage and pig on the Bog Shannaw. And since the letter that Tobin got saying that as he had started to come to him, not a bit of news had he heard or seen of Katie Maherner. Tobin advertised in the papers, but nothing could be found of the Colleen. So, to Coney me and Tobin went, thinking that a turn at the chutes, and the smell of the popcorn, might raise the heart in his bosom. But Tobin was a hard-headed man, and the sadness stuck in his skin. He ground his teeth at the crying balloons. He cursed the moving pictures. And, though he would drink whenever asked, he scorned Punch and Judy, and was for licking the tintype men as they came. So I gets him down a sideway on a boardwalk, where the attractions were some less violent. At a little 6x8 stall, Tobin halts, with a more human look in his eye. "'Tis here," says he, "I will be diverted. I'll have the palm of me hand investigated by the wonderful palmist of the Nile, and see if what is to be will be." Tobin was a believer in signs and the unnatural in nature. He possessed illegal convictions in his mind along the subjects of black cats, lucky numbers, and the weather predictions in the papers. We went into the enchanted chicken coop, which was fixed mysterious with red cloth, and pictures of hands with lines crossing them like a railroad center. The sign over the door says it is Madame Zozo, the Egyptian palmist. There was a fat woman inside in a red jumper with pothooks and beasties embroidered upon it. Tobin gives her 10 cents, and extends one of his hands. She lifts Tobin's hand, which is own brother to the hoof of a dray horse, and examines it to see whether 'tis a stone in the frog, or a cast shoe he has come for. "Man," says this Madame Zozo, "the line of your fate shows, 'tis not me foot at all," says Tobin, interrupting. "Your, 'tis no beauty, but thee hold the palm of me hand." "The line shows," says the Madame, "that thee have not arrived at your time of life without bad luck. And there's more to come. The mound of Venus, or is that a stone bruise, shows that thee have been in love. There's been trouble in your life on account of your sweetheart. 'Tis Katie Maherner as he has references with," whispers Tobin to me in a loud voice to one side. "I see," says the palmist, "a great deal of sorrow and tribulation with one whom he cannot forget. I see the lines of designation point to the letter K and the letter M in her name." "Whist," says Tobin to me, "do ye hear that? Look out," goes on the palmist, "for a dark man and a light woman, for they'll both bring ye trouble. Ye'll make a voyage upon the water very soon, and have a financial loss. I see one line that brings good luck. There's a man coming into your life who will fetch ye good fortune. Ye'll know him when ye see him by his crooked nose." "Is his name set down?" asks Tobin. "'Twill be convenient in the way of greeting, when he backs up to dump off the good luck." "His name," says the palmist, thoughtful looking, "is not spelled out by the lines, but they indicate 'tis a long one, and the letter O should be in it. There's no more to tell. Good evening. Don't lock up the door. 'Tis wonderful how she knows, says Tobin as we walk to the pier. As we squeezed through the gates, a nigger man sticks his lighted cigar against Tobin's ear, and there is trouble. Tobin hammers his neck, and the women squeal, and by presence of mind I drag the little man out of the way before the police comes. Tobin is always in an ugly mood when enjoying himself. On the boat going back, when the man calls, who wants the good-looking waiter? Tobin tried to plead guilty, feeling the desire to blow the foam off a crock of suds, but when he felt in his pocket he found himself discharged for lack of evidence. Somebody had disturbed his change during the commotion. So we sat, dry, upon the stools, listening to the dagoes fiddling on deck. If anything, Tobin was lower in spirits and less congenial with his misfortunes than when we started. On a seat against the railing was a young woman dressed suitable for red automobiles, with hair the color of an unsmoked meerschaum. In passing by, Tobin kicks her foot without intentions, and, being polite to ladies when in drink, he tries to give his hat a twist while apologizing. But he knocks it off, and the wind carries it overboard. Tobin came back and sat down, and I began to look out for him, for the man's adversities were becoming frequent. He was apt, when pushed so close by hard luck, to kick the best-dressed man he could see, and try to take command of the boat. Presently Tobin grabs my arm and says, excited. On, says he, do ye know what we're doing? We're taking a voyage upon the water. There now, says I, subdue yourself. The boat apostrophe L1 land in 10 minutes more. Look, says he, at the light lady upon the bench. And have ye forgotten the nigger man that burned me ear? And isn't the money I had gone $1.65 it was? I thought he was no more than summing up his catastrophe so as to get violent with good excuse, as men will do, and I tried to make him understand such things was trifles. Listen, says Tobin. Ye have no ear for the gift of prophecy, or the miracles of the inspired. What did the promised lady tell ye out of me hand? 'Tis coming true before your eyes. Look out, apostrophe says she, for a dark man and a light woman. They'll bring ye trouble. Apostrophe apostrophe have ye forgot the nigger man, though be got some of it back from me fist? Can ye show me a lighter woman than the blonde lady, that was the cause of me hat falling in the water? And where's the $1.65 I had in me vest, when we left the shooting gallery? The way Tobin put it, it did seem to corroborate the art of prediction, though it looked to me that these accidents could happen to anyone at Coney without the implication of palmistry. Tobin got up and walked around on deck, looking close at the passengers out of his little red eyes. I asked him the interpretation of his movements. Ye never know what Tobin has in his mind until he begins to carry it out. Ye should know, says he, I'm working out the salvation promised by the lines in me palm. I'm looking for the crooked nose man that's to bring the good luck. 'Tis all that will save us. John, did ye ever see a straighter nosed gang of hellions in the days of your life? 'Twas the 9:30 boat, and we landed and walked uptown through 22nd Street, Tobin being without his hat. On a street corner, standing under a gaslight and looking over the elevated road at the moon, was a man. A long man he was, dressed decent, with a cigar between his teeth, and I saw that his nose made two twists from bridge to end, like the wriggle of a snake. Tobin saw it at the same time, and I heard him breathe hard like a horse when you take the saddle off. He went straight up to the man, and I went with him. Good night to ye, Tobin says to the man. The man takes out his cigar and passes the compliments, sociable. Would ye hand us your name, asks Tobin, and let us look at the size of it? It may be our duty to become acquainted with ye. My name, says the man, polite, is Friaden Osman Maximus G. Friaden Osman. 'Tis the right length, says Tobin. Oh, you spell it with an O anywhere down the stretch of it? I do not, says the man. Tilde C-A-N tilde ye spell it with an O? Inquires Tobin, turning anxious. If your conscience, says the man with the nose, is indisposed toward foreign idioms, he might, to please yourself, smuggle the letter into the penultimate syllable. 'Tis well, says Tobin. Here in the presence of John Malone and Daniel Tobin. 'Tis highly appreciated, says the man, with a bow. And D now, since I cannot conceive that he would hold a spelling bee upon the street corner, will he name some reasonable excuse for being at large? By the two signs, answers Tobin, trying to explain, which he display according to the reading of the Egyptian palmist from the sole of me hand, ye have been nominated to offset with good luck the lines of trouble leading to the nigger man, and the blonde lady with her feet crossed in the boat, besides the financial loss of $1.65, also far fulfilled according to oil. The man stopped smoking, and looked at me. Have ye any amendments, he asks, to offer to that statement, or are ye one too? I thought by the looks of ye might have him in charge. None, says I to him, except that as one horseshoe resembles another, so are ye the picture of good luck as predicted by the hand of me friend. If not, then the lines of Danny's hand may have been crossed, I don't know. There's two of ye, says the man with the nose, looking up and down for the sight of a policeman. Have enjoyed your company immense. Good night. With that he shoves his cigar in his mouth and moves across the street, stepping fast. But Tobin sticks close to one side of him and me at the other. What? Says he, stopping on the opposite sidewalk and pushing back his hat. Do ye follow me? I tell ye, he says, very loud, I'm proud to have met ye. But it is my desire to be rid of ye. I am off to me home. Do, says Tobin, leaning against his sleeve. Oh, be off to your home, and I will sit at the door of it till ye come out in the morning. For the dependence is upon ye to obviate the curse of the nigger man, and the blonde lady and the financial loss of the 165. 'Tis a strange hallucination, says the man, turning to me as a more reasonable lunatic. Hadn't ye better get him home? Listen, man, says I to him. Anil Tobin is as sensible as he ever was. Maybe he is a bit deranged on account of having drink enough to disturb, but not enough to settle his wits, but he is no more than following out the legitimate path of his superstitions and predicaments, which I will explain to you. With that I relates the facts about the palmist lady, and how the finger of suspicion points to him as an instrument of good fortune. Ah, understand, I concludes, my position in this riot. I am the friend of me friend Tobin, according to me interpretations. 'Tis easy to be a friend to the prosperous, for it pays. 'Tis not hard to be a friend to the poor, for ye get puffed up by gratitude, and have your picture printed standing in front of a tenement with a scuttle of coal, and an orphan in each hand. But it strains the art of friendship, to be true friend to a born fool. And that's what I'm doing, says I, for, in my opinion, there's no fortune to be read from the palm of me hand that wasn't printed there with the handle of a pick. And, though ye have got the crookedest nose in New York City, I misdoubt that all the fortune tellers doing business could milk good luck from me. But the lines of Danny's hand pointed to ye fair, and I'll assist him to experiment with ye until he's convinced ye are dry. After that the man turns, sudden, to laughing. He leans against a corner and laughs considerable. Then he claps me and Tobin on the backs of us, and takes us by an arm apiece. 'Tis my mistake, says he. How could I be expecting anything so fine and wonderful to be turning the corner upon me? I came near being found unworthy. Hard by, says he, is a cafe, snug and suitable for the entertainment of idiosyncrasies. Let us go there, and have drink, while we discuss the unavailability of the categorical. So saying, he marched me and Tobin to the back room of a saloon, and ordered the drinks, and laid the money on the table. He looks at me and Tobin like brothers of his, and we have the cigars. Ye must know, says the man of destiny, that me walk in life is one that is called the literary. I wander abroad benight seeking idiosyncrasies in the masses and truth in the heavens above. When he came upon me, I was in contemplation of the elevated road in conjunction with the chief luminary of night. The rapid transit is poetry and art. The moon but a tedious, dry body, moving by road. But these are private opinions, for, in the business of literature, the conditions are reversed. 'Tis me hope to be writing a book, to explain the strange things I have discovered in life. Ye will put me in a book, says Tobin, disgusted. Will ye put me in a book? I will not, says the man, for the covers will not hold ye. Not yet. The best I can do, is to enjoy ye myself, for the time is not ripe for destroying the limitations of print. Ye would look fantastic in type. All alone by myself, must I drink this cup of joy. But, I thank ye, boys, I am truly grateful. The talk of ye, says Tobin, blowing through his mustache and pounding the table with his fist, is an eyesore to me patience. There was good luck promised out of the crook of your nose, but ye bear fruit like the bang of a drum. Ye resemble, with your noise of books, the wind blowing through a crack. Sure, now, I would be thinking the palm of me hand lied, but for the coming true of the nigger man, and the blonde lady and, whist, says the long man, would ye be led astray by physiognomy? Me nose will do what it can within bounds. Let us have these glasses filled again, for 'tis good to keep idiosyncrasies well moistened, they being subject to deterioration in a dry moral atmosphere. So, the man of literature makes good, to my notion, for he pays, cheerful, for everything, the capital of me, and Tobin being exhausted by prediction. But Tobin is sore, and drinks quiet, with the red showing in his eye. By and by we moved out, for 'twas 11 o'clock, and stands a bit upon the sidewalk. And then the man says he must be going home, and invites me, and Tobin to walk that way. We arrives on a side street 2 blocks away, where there is a stretch of brick houses with high stoops and iron fences. The man stops at one of them, and looks up at the top windows which he finds dark. 'Tis me humble dwelling, says he, and I begin to perceive by the signs, that me wife has retired to slumber. Therefore I will venture a bit in the way of hospitality. 'Tis me wish, that ye enter the basement room, where we dine, and partake of a reasonable refreshment. There will be some fine cold fowl and cheese, and a bottle or two of ale. Ye will be welcome to enter and eat, for I am indebted to ye for diversions. The appetite and conscience of me, and Tobin was congenial to the proposition, though 'twas sticking hard in Danny's superstitions to think that a few drinks and a cold lunch should represent the good fortune promised by the palm of his hand. Step down the steps, says the man with the crooked nose, and I will enter by the door above, and let thee in. I will ask the new girl we have in the kitchen, says he, to make ye a pot of coffee, to drink before ye go. 'Tis fine coffee Katie Maherner makes for a green girl just landed 3 months. Step in, says the man, and I'll send her down to ye. The gift of the Maji, $1.87. That was all. And 60 cents of it was in pennies. Pennies saved one and two at a time, by bulldozing the grocer and the vegetable man, and the butcher until one's cheeks burned with the silent imputation of parsimony that such close dealing implied. 3 times Della counted it. $1.87. And the next day would be Christmas. There was clearly nothing to do but flop down on the shabby little couch and howl. So Della did it. Which instigates the moral reflection that life is made up of sobs, sniffles, and smiles, with sniffles predominating. While the mistress of the home is gradually subsiding from the first stage to the second, take a look at the home. A furnished flat at $8 per week. It did not exactly beggar description, but it certainly had that word on the lookout for the mendicancy squad. In the vestibule below was a letterbox into which no letter would go, and an electric button from which no mortal finger could coax a ring. also appertaining thereunto was a card bearing the name Mr. James Dillingham Young. The Dillingham had been flung to the breeze during a former period of prosperity, when its possessor was being paid $30 per week. Now, when the income was shrunk to $20, the letters of Dillingham looked blurred, as though they were thinking seriously of contracting to a modest and unassuming D. But whenever Mr. James Dillingham Young came home, and reached his flat above, he was called in, and greatly hugged by Mrs. James Dillingham Young, already introduced to you as Della. Which is all very good. Della finished her cry and attended to her cheeks with the powder rag. She stood by the window and looked out dully at a gray cat walking a gray fence in a gray backyard. Tomorrow would be Christmas Day, and as he had only $1.87 with which to buy Jim a present. As he had been saving every penny she could for months, with this result. $20 a week doesn't go far. Expenses had been greater than as he had calculated. They always are. Only $1.87 to buy a present for Jim. Her Jim. Many a happy hour as he had spent planning for something nice for him. Something fine and rare, and sterling, something just a little bit near to being worthy of the honor of being owned by Jim. There was a pier glass between the windows of the room. Perhaps you have seen a pier glass in an $8 flat. A very thin and very agile person may, by observing his reflection in a rapid sequence of longitudinal strips, obtain a fairly accurate conception of his looks. Della, being slender, had mastered the art. Suddenly she whirled from the window and stood before the glass. Her eyes were shining brilliantly, but her face had lost its color within 20 seconds. Rapidly she pulled down her hair, and let it fall to its full length. Now, there were two possessions of the James Dillingham Youngs in which they both took a mighty pride. One was Jim's gold watch that had been his father's and his grandfather's. The other was Della's hair. Had the Queen of Sheba lived in the flat across the air shaft, Della would have let her hair hang out the window someday, to dry just to depreciate Her Majesty's jewels and gifts. Had King Solomon been the janitor, with all his treasures piled up in the basement, Jim would have pulled out his watch every time he passed, just to see him pluck at his beard from envy. So now Della's beautiful hair fell about her, rippling and shining like a cascade of brown waters. It reached below her knee, and made itself almost a garment for her. And then she did it up again nervously and quickly. Once she faltered for a minute and stood still, while a tear or two splashed on the worn red carpet. On went her old brown jacket, on went her old brown hat. With a whirl of skirts, and with the brilliant sparkle still in her eyes, she fluttered out the door, and down the stairs to the street. Where she stopped the sign read, Me. Sophrony. Hair goods of all kinds. One flight up Della ran, and collected herself, panting. Madam, large, too white, chilly, hardly looked the Sophrony. Will you buy my hair? Asked Della. I buy hair, said Madam. Take your hat off and let's have a sight at the looks of it. Down rippled the brown cascade. $20, said Madam, lifting the mass with a practiced hand. Give it to me quick, said Della. Oh, and the next 2 hours tripped by on rosy wings. Forget the ash metaphor. She was ransacking the stores for Jim's present. She found it at last. It surely had been made for Jim, and no one else. There was no other like it in any of the stores, and as he had turned all of them inside out. It was a platinum fob chain, simple, unchaste in design, properly proclaiming its value by substance alone, and not by meretricious ornamentation as all good things should do. It was even worthy of the watch. As soon as she saw it, she that it must be Jim's. It was like him. Quietness and value, the description applied to both. $21 they took from her for it, and she hurried home with the 87 cents. With that chain on his watch, Jim might be properly anxious about the time in any company. Grand as the watch was, he sometimes looked at it on the sly on account of the old leather strap that he used in place of a chain. When Della reached home, her intoxication gave way a little to prudence and reason. She got out her curling irons, and lighted the gas, and went to work repairing the ravages made by generosity added to love. Which is always a tremendous task, dear friends, a mammoth task. Within 40 minutes her head was covered with tiny, close-lying curls that made her look wonderfully like a truant schoolboy. She looked at her reflection in the mirror long, carefully, and critically. If Jim doesn't kill me, she said to herself, before he takes a second look at me, he'll say I look like a Coney Island chorus girl. But what could I do? Oh, what could I do with $1.87? At 7 o'clock the coffee was made, and the frying pan was on the back of the stove hot and ready to cook the chops. Jim was never late. Della doubled the fob chain in her hand, and sat on the corner of the table near the door that he always entered. Then she heard his step on the stairway down on the first flight, and she turned white for just a moment. As he had a habit for saying little. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.